Call this meeting of the Senate Judiciary Committee to order. It is 1:48 p.m. and it is Wednesday, March 22nd, 2023. Before we begin, I want to thank Joanna Crossett, the Senate Judiciary Secretary, who makes sure we have a transcript of our meetings, and Jake Wade from the Juneau LIO, who makes sure we have sound. At this time, I want to remind committee members and all those in the room to please silence your cell phones. Present today, we have Senator Kaufman. Senator Giesel is absent, attending another committee meeting. Senator Tobin is on teleconference. My Vice Chair, Senator Keel, and myself, Senator Klayman. We have a quorum to conduct business. Our first order of business today is a discussion of court rules and grand jury with the court system and the Department of Law. Today we are joined both by Nancy Mead, General Counsel of the Alaska Court System, and John Skidmore, Deputy Attorney General. The Criminal Division, we'll start with Ms. Mead. If you would please come forward, identify yourself for the record, and then you may begin your remarks. And I would note that at 1:49, Senator Tobin left teleconference and joined us in person. Ms. Mead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I am Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System. I was asked to give a summary of the grand jury process and what its functions are and explain a little bit about what it is, and in particular to speak to some recent court rule change regarding grand jury's functions. I will say I am happy to take questions. If there's a particular area that I gloss over, I would be pleased to address that and if you ask me the direct question. I will begin by sort of globally saying, what is a grand jury? You're probably quite familiar with petit juries. When most people are summoned for jury duty, they expect to be on a trial jury. 12 people for a felony or 6 for a misdemeanor, and you consider the evidence and decide innocence or guilt. A grand jury is also a group of citizens, 12 to 18 by statute, who are empowered by law to consider evidence that's presented to it by a prosecutor and then to decide whether to issue an indictment, also known as a true bill, or to issue a not true bill, which means we do not indict that person. This is an early step under the Alaska Constitution. It's used only for felonies. To ensure that the state has probable cause to believe that a crime has been committed by the defendant. And that is what grand juries do 99.9% of the time, if not 100% for a few decades in a row. They serve as a group for a set time period, and it varies by location how that time period is set. For example, the grand jurors who are summoned in Anchorage serve for 1 week a month, say the first week of the month, for 4 months. Or 3 months. In some locations, it might be every Wednesday for 3 months, report at 9 a.m., and they do their work as long as they need to. That is, as long as the prosecutor is presenting cases and asking them for their decision as to whether to indict or not. At the end of the day, they present the list of indictments and their decisions on all those cases. A judge accepts that list, and all their proceedings are secret. So they consider these multiple cases per sitting. But again, they're all secret for a number of reasons, and that is somewhat to protect the target in case they decide not to indict. It would be injurious to somebody's reputation to know that that was being considered, perhaps. Sometimes it could be because the target could interfere with grand jury proceedings. It can protect the grand jurors themselves. And it largely is secret so that witnesses feel that they can give a full and frank disclosure of what they perceive the facts to be without fear of anything untoward stemming from that. In a grand jury room are those 12 to 18 grand jurors, the prosecutor who is presenting the evidence and running the proceeding, any witness that the prosecutor calls at that time, there is a court reporter, a person, an in-court clerk from the court system running the equipment to ensure that it's recorded. There's no judge in the room. There are no attorneys in the room other than that prosecutor and, you know, if some attorney has a grand juror. Witnesses are not entitled to bring in an attorney, for example. The evidence is only presented by the prosecutor, so in that sense, it's ex parte. That is, the defense doesn't get a chance to rebut any of the evidence or bring anything up. But again, it's just a preliminary step to to ensure that the state has that citizens think that the state has that probable cause to continue a felony case before the defendant is required to go to trial and risk a conviction. That is, as I say, almost exclusively historically what grand juries do. Under the Alaska Constitution, the grand juries can do and are empowered to do a second task, and that's because our Alaska Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, says that the power of grand juries to investigate and make recommendations concerning the public welfare or safety shall never be suspended. So that's the source of the power that then led to some court rule changes that I'll talk about in a minute. And so there is that constitutional right. It has been exercised in the past very rarely. It was exercised more in the 60s or 70s. That is, an issue of public welfare or safety could be brought to the grand jury, and has been for different things. 60s, 70s, and 80s, there were more of these. To my knowledge, and I will say that these would be secret even from me, unless the a report from a grand jury was made public for some reason. But to my knowledge, I will say that the last three grand juries until last year that we had in the state that did an investigation was one in 1985, and it had to do with then Governor Sheffield and whether there was some irregularity on his part in, I think it was awarding a contract. There was an investigative grand jury convened by the Attorney General at the time, and they issued a report suggesting that the Senate consider impeachment proceedings against Sheffield, which the Senate then did meet in special session, but that did not occur, as I'm sure you know. That was 1985. The next investigative grand jury that I'm aware of was in 1990, and then the then Attorney General brought a case to a grand jury for investigation concerning a teacher in the Anchorage School District who was allegedly having inappropriate relationships with students, and that situation brought in the police department and others that were involved in that investigation, and there were some allegations of misconduct. To be honest, I don't know the exact report that came out of that. I do know that some of it was made public because it then led to litigation called the O'Leary case by the police chief, thinking that, or alleging in this Supreme case that eventually made it to the Supreme Court, that the power of the grand jury to investigate should be completely unfettered, and the court disagreed with that analysis and said, no, there need to be some constraints. But that's not exactly what I'm here to talk about. I just know that there was an investigative grand jury in 1990. After that, the next grand jury that investigated something that I'm aware of was in 2015. So you can see how rare this is, from 1990 to 2015. And at that time, a sitting legislator wanted to have an investigative grand jury look into the Office of Children's Services for some perceived irregularities in the ways that they were handling certain families and children, obviously. That was brought to the Attorney General's office and presented by the prosecutor to the, or by the Attorney General's office to an investigative grand jury. The end result of that was a very short report suggesting that the issue might be better handled by the Office of the Ombudsman within the legislative branch. So that was 1990, then 2015. So in 2022, there were three different requests or issues brought to the court's attention by citizens who wanted an investigative grand jury. So we did not have adequate procedures to do that, or we did not have procedures in place to ensure that that would happen consistently across the districts. And those three cases had come to the attention of three different judges and three different courts, and they did begin to try to deal with these in three different ways. That came to the attention of the Supreme Court, which has, as you know, constitutional power to make rules of practice and procedure. The court does that all the time. I wanted to show you my prop. This is the court's Supreme Court rules of court. They're in all different areas: criminal rules, minor offense rules, civil rules, probate rules. And again, Article 4, Section 15 says the Supreme Court shall adopt these rules. So seeing and perceiving this lack of procedure, which for the first time became a problem, because prior to that, people had gone to the AG's office, and that was the assumed method, and the AG brought the cases to the to the investigative grand jury as appropriate. So at the towards the middle of 2022, the Supreme Court determined that it needed some recommendations on how to approach this issue, and a group got together to develop those recommendations. The recommendations were brought to the Supreme Court. They were considered, you know, sent back, considered. In any event, that led to the adoption by the Supreme Court of changes to Criminal Rule 6, a pre-existing rule on grand juries, and Criminal Rule 6.1, another pre-existing rule. Criminal Rule 6 is mostly about that whole first thing I talked about, how you get indictments in a criminal case through the grand jury process. And that rule says things like how those grand jurors are summoned, how a foreperson is chosen, where they're going to meet, very procedural aspects of the grand jury. And in addition, the court adopted changes to be much more explicit about what happens when somebody wants an investigative grand jury. That was put out as Supreme Court Order 1993. Supreme Court Order 1993, which I believe is in the packet that you probably received before this meeting, has changes mostly beginning on the bottom of page 2 to Criminal Rule 6.1. And in those changes, the Supreme Court provided rules about what qualified as a matter of public welfare or safety that can go before the grand jury to ensure that these investigations would be have a reasonable sort of scope and would be justified. And it then, in the subsection B on page 4, goes into what happens if a grand juror requests to investigate a matter. And that's because there's a particular statute that says that a grand juror, a seated grand juror, can bring up issues to his or her fellow grand jurors to have them investigated, and how the prosecutor is involved in that. So that's what subsection B is. On page 5 of the order that I think you have is how a citizen would request to initiate an investigative grand jury. Again, in the past, this was not seen as any gap in procedures because citizens went to the DA or figured out that's how you get an investigative grand jury. But in an effort to provide consistency and clarity, the Supreme Court put out these rules. What happens then under this rule is that a citizen can direct their concern to the Attorney General's office for consideration, and that office will review it and decide when and how to bring that issue to the attention of the grand jury for them to vote and see if they want to pursue it as an investigation. There has been some criticism. There have been some comments made by folks who want a citizen-led grand jury that this somehow suspends rights or curbs constitutional rights. I want to be clear that this does pretty much the opposite. It sets out how to effectuate that constitutional and statutory right, by the way, by making sure that people know where to go and how to do this. It appears that this is probably the only sensible way to effectuate that right, rather than having a citizen somehow enter a courthouse and go to a room that's literally locked and try to approach grand jurors individually when their identities are not really supposed to be public anyhow. The prosecutor is the person who brings any criminal cases to the grand jury. A judge isn't even in the room, as I mentioned. And so this process will ensure that the grand jury considers admissible evidence and is led in a more formal manner down a path through the investigation.
Senator Kaufman has a question.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, through the chair, Ms. Mead. So with that, I guess, difference of opinion there, can you explain maybe what's at the heart of it? What's the pivotal misunderstanding or What drives that impression, which is opposite of your informed opinion?
Through the chair to Senator Kaufman, there is in particular, as I say, there were three requests, although I don't know if how formal you would put it, three people who wanted investigative grand juries to be conducted in three different areas of the state. One of them, at least, alleged that they wanted stated they wanted the investigative grand jury to investigate problems with the judicial system, the judges, the prosecutors, the Bar Association, and others. In other words, an allegation that there was corruption permeating many, many different entities. And it is my sense that perhaps that person thought that it was improper for the Supreme Court to adopt a rule that would guide somebody with that sort of a allegation to the Attorney General's office for consideration. So we were aware of that allegation, and I will also say that this rule has provisions for if there is a conflict of interest with going to the Attorney General's office, it's spelled out what happens. That is, the Attorney General can appoint a neutral prosecutor, somebody who doesn't work for the Department of Law, to thereafter lead the investigation. And indeed, if a person on the grand jury believes that there still is a conflict of interest or a perceived conflict of interest and feels that the Attorney General's office did not appropriately address it by getting an outside prosecutor, that they can bring that to the attention of the judge for further consideration as to whether something else should happen. So I'm not 100% clear why people are still believe that this suspended rights as opposed to clarifying how you go about implementing or getting that right in front of the grand jury. But that is my sense of what I've heard some folks say.
Because we're at a quick pause, when the Supreme Court adopts changes or adopts new rules, as the case may be, do they just meet and decide, or is there a process that the court system engages with when there are changes to, in this case, the criminal rules? This is a little bit broader than narrow topic.
Thank you. To the chair, typically the Supreme Court gets recommendations for rule changes from its rules committees, and there are 8 standing rules committees, and those are people appointed by the Supreme Court to consider proposals from anywhere that come in from anyone for changes to the court rules or for suggestions that there's a gap and we need a court rule. So the criminal rules committee or the civil rules committee, depending on the substantive type area, would consider a proposal over a series of meetings and make recommendations through our court rules attorney to the Supreme Court. That is the process that is normally followed. And there's actually a rule called the rulemaking process in our administrative rules, which the Supreme Court wrote. But the Supreme Court also has authority, when necessary, to adopt rules in another manner. And in this case, it did not go through the Criminal Rules Committee because it rose to their attention, say, in, I want to say, August, and they felt that it was, they needed an expedient way to get a rule accomplished and passed faster than the Rules Committee process can allow. They did not have, 6 months or a year or sometimes 18 months to wait for a Rules Committee process, and so they worked with a small group of people, and in fact it was people from the court administrative office as well as the Department of Law, who would be able to work through these areas knowledgeably and efficiently and come up with recommendations for the court. Subsequent to that, however, subsequent to adopting these rule changes, the court did send them back to the Criminal Rules Committee and asked for additional analysis. Did we miss anything? Should we have done this differently? Is there more that we should add? And so they are still getting that guidance from the experts that they appointed and are open to additional recommendations should they come their way.
how big is the Criminal Rules Committee, and how is that populated? I mean, how many members and where do they come from?
The Criminal Rules Committee, I believe, has 13 members. There are I think there are five judges from different levels of courts. There are four people who have a prosecutorial outlook, by which I mean I think it's the municipal attorney from the city of Anchorage, somebody from the DA's office, somebody from the Office of Victims' Rights, and then the fourth I'm forgetting but might also be from the DA's office, I'm not certain. And then there are four defense attorneys, who are the public defender herself, I think two private defense lawyers, and an attorney from OPA. To my knowledge, I'm not swearing that that's the composition, but generally the Supreme Court likes to appoint a balanced committee to have a full airing of the issues. Again, this rule went through a more expedited process, but is now back at that committee for consideration.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the opportunity to take advantage of a pause in the presentation. Some baseline stuff I could use a hand with. Ms. Mead, you talk about the difference an investigative grand jury as sort of a separate creature. And can you talk to us about the ability of a sitting grand jury to serve in that purpose? Or why do we need a separate investigative grand jury for these reasons?
Through the chair to Senator Keel. This is a question that in some ways might be better for the Department of Law. The rule change itself leaves the conduct of the actual grand jury to the Attorney General's office, because that is the entity that traditionally handles grand juries. Now, if you're asking whether a full new group of 12 to 18 people would be an investigative grand jury versus the 12 to 18 people who are already summoned to be considering cases for a possible indictment, I am not certain how the Attorney General will do that. There are some things that the rule says, that the rule leaves to the Department of Law to actually to do as they see fit. I believe in the past, actually I don't know. I had assumed, as I think about it, I don't have a knowledge base to say why I assumed that prior investigative grand juries were summoned for particular investigations, and that may not be true now that I think it through. I don't have knowledge of that, I'm afraid.
Thank you, Mr. If I may,
Senator Keel.
As I spent a little time preparing for this hearing, you know, we all read our Constitutional Convention minutes regularly, of course, before bed, just me. I think it's fair to say that a lot of the delegates had no idea how this worked either. And there's a lot of discussion in there about the attorney members and non-attorney members and folks sort of trying to figure out what exactly they were talking about. So there is discussion about individuals bringing things to grand juries, and I think you mentioned in your introductory comments that it used to be more common that grand juries did the investigative piece. I could certainly use some help with what the situation would be or how the rule would apply if, for instance, a grand juror wanted something investigated, someone who was sitting. How would that work?
Through the chair to Senator Keel. I will just say preliminarily that, having read those minutes, back in 1959, it's my sense from those minutes that grand juries would meet approximately once a year. And there were therefore different views about what that grand jury should do. For example, our Constitution now says that a person can waive grand jury. And one wonders why anyone would do that, except that I know if it was only going to meet once a year and you had a whole year to be under potential indictment, somebody might have waived it. That isn't the case now, and to my knowledge, you see extremely few people, if any, waiving that. So things have evolved a little bit since 1959. So to directly answer your question, the rule change again, if you look at that Supreme Court order 1993, beginning on page 4, is new Rule 6.1B, grand juror request to investigate a matter of public welfare or safety. So if a grand juror wanted to do that, they would simply follow that rule, which says in B1, an individual grand juror may propose to the prosecuting attorney that the grand jury investigate the matter, and as long as it isn't as long as it is a matter of public welfare or safety, and it's not, the rule says, patently groundless, made for purposes of delay or harassment or otherwise in bad faith, then the prosecuting attorney shall present that to the grand jury. So that's how an individual grand juror would do it, and I believe in the 70s or something, that's about how it happened anyway. And the grand jurors would vote among themselves whether to then proceed with that. And again, that rule says if you think that the prosecutor or others might have a conflict of interest because the allegation has something to do with the Department of Law itself or would have an appearance of impropriety, then the attorney general can appoint a neutral prosecutor. And it goes on to say if an individual grand jury still thinks there's a problem there with an appearance of impropriety or conflict, they can approach the superior court for further proceedings on that point.
That's a helpful baseline.
Okay, just one. Okay, I don't want to get too, boring. Shortly after this was made effective in December, the Supreme Court actually reconsidered one of the changes it had just made. And in the original change in Supreme Court Order 1993, the court had said that the same grand jury who investigates, and this goes a little bit to Senator Keel's question, should not thereafter be the individuals, same individuals who would consider an indictment. On the theory that those who investigate might have considered evidence that wouldn't be admissible or might have a vested interest in seeing it through to indictment because they had worked pretty hard on this investigation or something. But upon reconsideration, the Supreme Court thought that it was questionable from the minutes of the Constitutional Convention whether that was indeed the founders' intent, and the Supreme Court took out that restriction so that the rule no longer says the same grand jury that investigates can't be the grand jury that issues the indictment. That will be, again, something that the prosecutor deals with. They will lead the investigation, and they will figure out how to get the indictment. But the rule doesn't prohibit the same grand jury from investigating and thereafter indicting on the same sets of facts. That was Supreme Court Order 2000. That was effective in early February, so approximately 2 months later. With that, I guess I'd be happy to take more questions. I could explain more, but I might have given you the information base you need on that. I'm not certain if you want more.
Well, at this point, I think what we'll do, unless there's questions now, we'll have Mr. Skidmore come up and give his perspective on these court rule changes, and then that may lead to questions that we want you to come back for. But we'll get Mr. Skidmore up next to provide his input on this.
Okay, I'll stay on call. Thank you.
Mr. Skidmore, welcome back.
Thank you. For the record, my name is John Skidmore. I'm the Deputy Attorney General for the Criminal Division for the State of Alaska Department of Law. I would begin by saying I would echo and agree with the vast majority, if not all, of Ms. Mead's comments. I had actually outlined comments to explain very similarly what grand juries do, and I found myself going, okay, well, I don't need to say that now. Okay, I don't need to say that now. Let me, though, in turn, try and provide a little bit of clarity on a couple of other issues. First, there was a question about whether or not an investigative grand jury would be separate from other already sitting grand juries. And the real question at the heart there deals with the idea that investigative grand juries, there are really two types. And grand jury has two functions. One, the primary function of the grand jury is to engage in a charging function. Screen cases, decide whether or not a citizen should be held over for a trial on a felony case. Investigative grand juries can be on criminal matters. You heard two that Ms. Mead alluded to. One involved a teacher in the Anchorage School District. Another one involved a former governor. In both instances, those were investigative grand juries that are similar to what many federal investigative grand juries are. That is, the grand jury process can be used as an investigative function in cases in which it's more difficult for the police to investigate a case. Where might that be? It's going to be in situations in which maybe there's voluminous records that need to be brought in, and a grand jury's subpoena power allows them to do that. A grand jury subpoena need not be based on probable cause. A police department who wants to obtain records or other information must obtain a search warrant, which does require probable cause. Grand juries do not require that. Ms. Mead also elaborated on some other aspects of grand juries, namely that they can be secret, and those secretive grand juries can serve a number of bases. There is the subpoena authority. There is lay participation, that is, regular citizens who come in and participate. It's not just government officials. They are closed proceedings. There are grants of immunity that can be considered and sometimes given to certain witnesses who come in and have to testify. And there are secrecy requirements. Investigative grand juries for a criminal investigation are generally thought of for things like a RICO violation, a major drug operation that
what
you want to investigate.
RICO?
Sorry. RICO is an acronym that refers to a federal statute for racketeering. And it's in those larger cases that are white-collar crimes, that are drug organizations, that are some other type of corruption, that all of those things I talked about, that subpoena authority, that they're closed proceedings to protect both the grand jurors themselves as well as the witnesses who show up, as well as to protect the people that are being investigated. Because if the grand jury decides there's not sufficient evidence for this to go forward, you don't want to ruin someone's reputation by saying they're being investigated. The grants of immunity and the secrecy, all of those are things that are built into the process, and so it can be very powerful. However, investigative grand juries, as they are described in our Constitution, don't typically talk about a criminal case being investigated. They talk about, and I'll use the words from the Constitution, public welfare or safety. Public welfare or safety, and if you go back and read those constitutional amendments, I fear many of us fell asleep reading those most recently. If you read those notes or those minutes, what they talk about is convening a grand jury once a year to consider other issues in the state that may be issues that the citizens want to look into. For example, how are our jails functioning? Is there something amiss with the way and what's going on with jails? And it talks about other efforts that can be made when it comes to state government and things that the citizens can review. Now, you heard Ms. Mead talk about the fact that there may have been more.
Let me just actually interrupt.
Sure.
You spoke about the federal investigative grand juries, which,
yes,
my understanding, those there are more federal investigative grand juries actively investigating whatever they're investigating than state grand juries.
Yes.
Do you see the federal power for investigative grand juries as different than the power for grand jury investigations under the Alaska Constitution in the reference to public welfare or safety? And if you see those powers differently, can you describe a little bit more of those differences?
To the chair, the answer is both yes and no. Can the state of Alaska conduct an investigatory grand jury for purposes of charging and ferreting out crime itself? The answer is yes. We do have that authority. We rarely engage in that because we don't have cases that are of that nature for us to conduct. But is that different than for public welfare or safety? The answer is also yes, that is different in terms of the type of conduct that they look into. I don't practice in the federal system. I have never conducted a federal grand jury nor appeared at a federal grand jury. However, if you look at the vast majority of the case law that is out there and the other treatises that talk about grand juries, they always talk about federal grand juries in the sense of investigating crime. It is only other states that use grand juries for this second purpose, which is public welfare or safety. And there are other states that have grand juries look at those sorts of issues. And as I was saying a moment ago, you can see that early on in the 60s or 70s, we may have had more of those. You ask, why not more since then? Well, in 1975, this body enacted the law that created the Ombudsman's Office. And the Ombudsman's Office now takes complaints about state government. and reviews most of those and has the authority within its own statute. If you're interested, the Ombudsman statute is 2455010-340. And the Ombudsman statutes talk about their ability to investigate and look into things and, when appropriate, to refer something to a grand jury themselves. But the Ombudsman's office took on a lot of that role that previously grand juries would have needed to take to look at whether or not there were issues of public welfare or safety within the state. And in fact, the last example of an investigative grand jury that Ms. Mead spoke of, one that dealt with OCS, the outcome of that grand jury was a referral to the Ombudsman's office because there was now another entity to really sort of address those types of issues or cases. And so all of that makes sense. And if you look at the rule change that was implemented, the rule change that was implemented was really designed to address those situations in which citizens were saying, hey, I think I have something that needs to go to a grand jury. And how does a citizen get that information to a grand jury? What's the process for that to occur? And the rule changes, I think, laid out a very clear process by which that's supposed to happen and also laid out a clear process of what should happen if there are conflicts. I would make one note, Ms. Mead described a neutral prosecutor as someone outside the department. That may not necessarily be the case. We have an Office of Special Prosecutions, which is segregated and walled off from most of our other offices, and we have historically, when we have conflicts for one case, say an Anchorage DA's case, we can refer that to another office, and it's handled by a different prosecutor's office. That's something that we've done historically within the Department of Law, and one of the reasons that we have an Office of Special Prosecutions. Now, there may be cases for which no one in the Department of Law should be the one that's assigned to it, and in those circumstances, I would agree with Ms. Mead. It would be appropriate to appoint a special prosecutor outside of the department, but that is not always the immediate place that we need to go to in order to find someone that is neutral. That's basically what I would share with you all. I have lots of other notes. I have lots of other research, but I want to make sure that I'm attentive to the questions that you all have. And I also want to recognize that the committee had other things on their calendar today as well.
Including a bill you're presenting. So,
there is that, Mr. Chair.
Are there questions from the committee with respect to the grand jury process, either for Mr. Skidmore or Ms. Mead? Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess the question for Mr. Skidmore is the commentary on the rule. The Supreme Court said something that I don't understand, and maybe you can help me with it.
Okay.
Because the grand jury provisions don't appear under sections of the Constitution having to do with the executive. But the note in the commentary says decisions as to what to present to the grand jury, including whether to present something a citizen brings forward,
sure,
rest with the executive branch. Why ought we think of that as an executive branch function rather than a function of the grand jury to decide what it investigates?
Through the chair to Senator Keel, I would actually tell you that grand juries, no matter what jurisdiction you're in, are a function of two different branches of government which have to cooperate and work together. One is the legislature, the other one is the executive. The judicial and the executive, excuse me. The judicial is very clearly the entity that calls the grand jurors together, that can summon a grand jury, that can impanel a grand jury. They are ones that review decisions of the grand jury to determine if they follow the law and all those other sorts of issues. But the actual presentations of evidence at the grand jury occur by the executive branch. I believe the Supreme Court, in adopting the rule, indicated that what should happen is that a citizen should bring information forward to the executive branch. The executive branch would review it first to determine did it meet that legal threshold of public welfare or safety, because if it doesn't, then the grand jury is not authorized to address it. If it does meet that initial threshold, then I think what the court rule does is it's deferring to the executive branch, okay, well, you get to bring the cases then that you want to bring. The reason for that is because the court rule cannot direct the executive to take different action. That would be a violation of the separations of powers. However, the executive branch intends to bring any case that meets the threshold of public welfare or safety to a grand jury. And to your point, isn't it the grand jury that gets to decide? I would agree with you. And the rule actually specifically lays out that when there is an investigative issue to be brought, we bring that to the grand jury, we describe it to them, and they decide whether or not they want to investigate. From very early on, grand juries have been recognized to be costly, to be cumbersome, and it's the individual citizens serving who decide how they should be using their time and what they do with that. In fact, grand juries in 1820 were criticized by a gentleman back in England who said grand juries should not be occurring and we shouldn't be indicting people by grand juries. It's too cumbersome and it shouldn't be happening. There are other states here in our country that ultimately decided grand juries would not be used for purposes of indictment, and that was actually upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court, that a grand jury was not needed for cases to go to trial, even when they were felonies. But the ultimate concept is, when you still are using grand jurors, the grand jurors themselves control what happens there. That's why they're both a sword and a shield. A shield because they protect citizens from what some would say would be an overzealous prosecutor. They decide what they're going to investigate. They decide what they're going to indict. But it does have to meet minimum threshold levels, and I believe that's what the rule is talking about. That's what the commentary is talking about having occur.
Mr. Chairman, if I may.
Senator Keel.
It may be fair to actually ask the court system's representative that same question, since I just asked the Attorney General's office about what the Supreme Court put out.
Mr. Skimmer, you can stay there.
I guess my one thought on that problem with the sword and the shield image is that you still need the executive branch to pick both of them up. It serves as the precursor before it can be invoked at all the way this is written. So that's what I'm grappling with.
Through the chair to Senator Keel, and I understand your question. I think that I would only add to what Mr. Skidmore said, that in all cases, in all grand jury proceedings, no matter what they're considering, investigations or indictments, there is a legal advisor in the room, and that legal advisor is always the prosecuting attorney. And the commentary to 6.1c1 that you're referring to says that decisions as to what to present rest with the executive branch. And I will say that's pinned on the statute, AS 1240070, which lays out that it is the duty of the prosecutor to bring everything to a grand jury. No judge can be in that room. It's the only legal advisor there can be. So the statute contemplates that, and that same concept is echoed in existing for a long time, Criminal Rule 6, which says that the prosecuting attorney shall prepare all indictments and presentments to the grand jury, shall attend its sittings to advise it of its duty and to examine witnesses in its proceedings. There needs to be somebody in charge who's aware of, for example, evidence rules that the lay members of the grand jury would not be. That has always been the prosecutor's office, and another entity it doesn't even spring to mind that could fulfill that function.
Separate line of inquiry? Thank you. At the risk of giving our presenters a little whiplash, the delegates were also worried about runaway grand juries, and that's reflected in the minutes as well. And I appreciate what Ms. Mead just said about somebody needed to know the rules of evidence. So I struggle a little bit with the end of this constitutional provision on grand juries. Many of the provisions in the Declaration of Rights article say the rights shall not be infringed. This one says the power of the grand juries, especially to have these investigations, shall never be suspended. And since I've got a pair of attorneys in front of me, how should I understand the different word choice there as we look at this?
I'll take a stab through the chair to Senator Keel. I actually went through the whole that section of the Constitution rights, and the fact that it will never be suspended stuck out to me as unique wording. In every other instance where one could say a citizen has a right, the Constitution is worded in such a way as to be clear that the citizen has the right, as opposed to this sentence, right? So the constitutional drafters knew how to say the right of X shall never be denied, or a citizen may never be denied, or a citizen shall always have. That is different from this sentence saying the power of the grand jury won't be suspended, which is further evidence that citizens themselves are not afforded a direct right to confront a grand jury, but grand juries themselves can determine whether they intend to go forward with an investigation. It shall never be suspended in now my parlance would mean you can't say that there is no such thing. I think that because of this concept of runaway grand juries in other jurisdictions, they do not have investigative grand juries, even if it's something that was contemplated. And in fact, that right of the grand jury has been suspended. Here it is not suspended. And again, the court rule change doesn't suspend it. It articulates how to go ahead and effectuate it. So I don't know if I'm exactly telling you what it means, but it's clear to me that that wording is way different from wording that says a citizen has a right, because that is how the rest of those rights are articulated by the drafters.
Mr. Skidmore, do you want to add anything to the response? Not required.
I appreciate that, Mr. Chair. I would agree with Ms. Mead's interpretation. Suspended in this instance is about the power not being taken away from the grand jury. Power isn't taken away from the grand jury. The rules that have been promulgated by the Supreme Court, which they're constitutionally allowed to do, indicate how that power is to be exercised. It does not suspend it. Suspending it would be saying, you don't get to do it. That's not what these rules do. That's not what the amendments do. The amendments lay out a clear path for how it is supposed to work. I further agree with Ms. Mead that most of the other rights that are articulated are for the citizens. But a grand jury is not an individual citizen's right. It is the power of the body itself to engage in things, and not an individual citizen's rights to do more. In fact, I would note that there is significant case law outside the state of Alaska about individuals who have approached grand juries to attempt to influence them and how they should operate. And in those instances, many citizens have been charged and convicted for contempt, interfering with official proceedings. Those are not things we've had to encounter here in Alaska, and I certainly hope that we don't. But the guidance that was provided by these rules was to help citizens understand how they can avail themselves to the power of the grand jury without running afoul of those other criminal law.
I would just add to that another way of pondering that is that that constitutional language about shall not be suspended in the recent times of the pandemic. The pandemic would not be a cause in which somebody could say, for the next 3 months, we will not hold grand jury proceedings. In fact, the grand jury's power to do what it does, even during a pandemic, shall not be suspended.
And I would note that during the pandemic, grand juries did continue to function. We found ways to make that happen.
Senator, did you have more follow-up before I interrupted?
No. Well, Mr. Chairman, sort of a final observation. I think the Alaskans who are reacting to this rule negatively seem to be concerned that the gatekeeper role has become a bar to entry, and that their concern, if I could dare restate it for them, is that the gatekeeper has functionally become a suspension of the grand jury's power to have stuff put in front of it. And so that's what I'm struggling with a little bit as I read the rule. I will continue to think on it, but that is, I guess, the concern as it's been expressed. And I think it's valuable that it's not an individual right. That's an important consideration, but that's what I'm chewing on.
Senator Kaufman.
No, you're good. Okay. Okay.
I don't see any other questions for the committee. Thank you both very much for appearing today. We do have enough time. Mr. Skidmore, you don't need to leave. You may need to get some notes, but
I have to shift my notes.
Okay. We'll take a short, we won't take an Eddie's, but we'll take a short pause while Mr. Skidmore gets his different notes, and I'll read from my script. Our second and final order of business today is Senate Bill 64, Controlled Substances, Homicide, Good Time, Deductions, sponsored by the Senate Rules Committee by request of the governor. This is the first hearing of the bill in the Senate Judiciary Committee. Here to present the bill is John Skidmore, Deputy Director, Criminal Division of the Department of Law. We also have folks online who are available to answer questions. These include these also include Nancy Mead, General Counsel of the Court System, Kate Talmadge, aide to Deputy Director Skidmore, Lisa Purinton, no, actually she's not with us, Lieutenant Scott Bartlett, Alaska State Troopers, looks like Sydney Wood, Operations Manager, Institutions, Department of Corrections, and Mike Matthews, Lead Research Analyst, Department of Corrections. And Mr. Skidmore would just note we have a few people here for public testimony and potentially invited testimony, and so I would just, why don't we give you at least a good 10 to 12 minutes. At about 10 minutes to the hour, we'll take a pause as necessary to get the public testimony through, and then we can come back to you and conclude.
Thank you. For the record, again, John Skidmore, Deputy Attorney General for the Criminal Division of the State of Alaska Department of Law. And, Mr. Chair, I very much appreciate that. I intended to keep my comments very brief to introduce the bill so we can get to the invited and public testimony for folks that I know are both here in person as well as on the phone. This particular bill that's in front of you all today, SB 64, is really here for the purposes of deciding how should Alaska as a state respond to a situation that has resulted in an increase in Alaskan deaths. That is, annually we used to see about 100 to 140 Alaskans each year killed from drug overdoses. Now that number has increased to over 250 per year. That's a dramatic increase, and that's an increase that demands the attention of the leaders in Alaska about how are we going to deal with that, how are we going to respond to that. This bill is but one part of the proposal in how to respond to that. This is not the sum and substance. This is not everything. This is part of the solution. This part of the solution is talking about taking a provision that already exists in Alaska law in the crime of manslaughter. In manslaughter, if a person knowingly manufactures or delivers a controlled substance in violation of other state laws, and a person dies as the direct result of the ingestion of that controlled substance, it is classified as a manslaughter. That is a Class A felony offense. It has a presumptive range of 4 to 7 years for a first-time offender, a maximum of 20 years. This proposal that's in front of you would lift that provision of manslaughter and move it to murder in the second degree. The reason it does that is because of the dramatic increase in deaths. I would note that increase in deaths is driven largely by two substances, fentanyl and methamphetamine. Both of them have dramatically increased overdose deaths. I believe you all were provided a document in aid of today's hearing. This is a Alaska Facts and Figures from the Alaska Department of Health, the Division of Public Health. This is a report that was prepared on July 25th of 2022. I would direct your attention to page 5. There's a graph in figure 2 that is overdose death rates by drug between 2012 and 2021. That graph very clearly illustrates the blue line with the circles, the overall number of drug overdose deaths and the way in which they increased or spiked. However, you then have it broken down into narcotics. Narcotics include opioids, and you can see how the overdose deaths rose for that particular drug. And then you also have another line, which is psychotropics. Psychotropics are represented in the purple. The narcotics are represented in the red. The psychotropics, you will note, have a similar trajectory in terms of increases, and the psychotropics you'll note in Table 8 back on page 4 include methamphetamine, because methamphetamine was the second type of drug that drove this overdose increase. And if you don't like graphs, you prefer narrative, I would refer you to page 6, the discussion at the bottom of the page. There's a paragraph there, and if you go down to about the third or fourth line of it, it says the largest increases were seen in overdose deaths involving fentanyl, a synthetic opioid, and methamphetamine, a psychostimulant, increasing 150% or 148%, respectively. By increasing this, what does it allow us to do? It allows us to pursue those individuals that peddle these poisons to our citizens more aggressively. How frequently does that occur? The answer, not very frequently. Despite the number of overdose deaths, our ability to prosecute those cases is very, very limited. The reason for that is because of the elements of the crime. We have to show that the drugs that were provided were a direct cause of the death of the person involved. We have to be able to trace those drugs back to the individual that provided them. So presenting those cases is not something that we are able to do as much as we would like to. I'm not asking you to change the challenges for us in presenting them. What the bill does ask you to do is to authorize a greater penalty to be associated for the people who engage in that conduct. And part of that is done because of the dramatic increases in deaths that we are seeing. We need to have tools that allow us to be more aggressive in how we sanction people who engage in that conduct. That's a short summary of what's there. There was another document that was also provided that lays out schedules and helps you to understand the various drugs and the scheduling that's in those drugs. There is a second part of the bill that also deals with good time provisions. I'm going to save my comments on that until after public testimony and invited testimony, because I believe most of the folks that are here are interested in addressing those first parts. So unless there are other questions, I would yield at this time for purposes of that testimony.
Any questions from members of the committee? I'm sure there'll be some questions after public testimony. And did you have we have some invited testimony as well?
Yes. Ms. Snodgrass should be listed as invited testimony. I believe there are others that are here as public testimony.
Okay, yes, that's correct. Thank you, Mr. Skidmore. And don't go far, because if we have time, we'll...
I'll be right here in the room.
Pick up the pace. But first, for invited testimony, we have Sandy Snodgrass with the Alaska Fentanyl Response Project. Ms. Snodgrass, welcome to Senate Judiciary. If you want to sit down and identify yourself and any affiliation you may have, and then you can proceed with your remarks. We tend to be a little less strict on time limits for invited testimony, but I would encourage you to kind of keep your comments at about the three-minute mark.
Thank you, Chair, Mr. Klayman, and the Senate Committee, Senate Judiciary Committee, today for hearing my comments in support of Senate Bill 64. My name is Sandy Snodgrass. I'm the CEO of AK Fentanyl Response Project. My son, Robert Bruce Snodgrass, died from a 100% fentanyl poisoning in Anchorage, Alaska on October 21st of 2021. So since that time, and since that toxicology report came back, fentanyl, I've been working in any area and all areas to stand up a response to the fentanyl epidemic in the state of Alaska and the country. Fentanyl, as Mr. Skidmore has said, has increased. Alaska's number one in the nation for the increase in fentanyl deaths, and that's unacceptable to me as an Alaskan. So I am... talk about the three legs of the stool, and this law is public safety, and that's one leg of the stool, the law enforcement side. I'm trying to do as much prevention and outreach as I can. The state of Alaska is standing up treatment centers as fast as they can stand them up for people that survive fentanyl poisoning and seek treatment. So this body and this law can provide one leg of that stool, and we need to use all the tools that we have to stand up a response to fentanyl in this state. I'm hopeful that the leaders of this committee will move this bill forward so that Alaskans have faith in our representatives, that they're taking care of our children. This is a children's issue in the state of Alaska. It's fastly affecting young people in the state of Alaska, including my son. He was 22 years old when he died. I don't think they know or understand what fentanyl is, and I certainly want to tell them. This law, I think, is one of the tools that can be used in prosecution to negotiate with lower level drug dealers. I'm not looking to put the drug dealer that sold my son a little bit of fentanyl. I'm looking for DTOs, drug traffickers, drug trafficking organizations that are bringing this into the state that are targeting Alaskans because of the increased amount of money they can get, especially in rural areas. You can sell a pill in Anchorage for $20. You can sell a pill in Togiak for $80. And they're targeting that. And until we have all the tools that we can bring to bear on this, they're going to continue to kill Alaskans. So I'm thank you so much for hearing me today. I hope that you can learn and understand the scope of the issue of fentanyl in Alaska. And there's another drug, xylazine, that's coming that kills people even quicker. It's coming. Their drug trafficking organizations out of Mexico are coming for us. And we need to use every tool that we have. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I think I speak on behalf of all the committees that we really are very sorry about your loss and your son's death. Are there any questions from the committee from this address? Senator Kaufman.
Thank you, I guess. Through the chair, Ms. Snodgrass, sort of a question, but our conversation yesterday, you likened this to if there were air crashes that resulted in these fatalities. And could you just kind of have that conversation here with the committee that you have with me?
Through the chair to Representative Kaufman. Yeah, one of the things that we
talked about. Senator Kaufman.
Senator Kaufman. I'm very sorry.
We've decided I'm a representative for my first year in the Senate.
Senator Kaufman and I have both been having identity issues today, so you're well, you have very good company.
Thank you very much for the question. So one of the analogies that really brings this home for people, and I use it quite often, is right now the CDC and the DEA estimate that 300 Americans die every single day in this country from drug-related overdoses and fentanyl poisonings. I do not use the word overdose when I talk about fentanyl. It's poison. The amount that it takes to kill you can sit on the tip of a pencil. That is not an overdose. That's poisoning. 300 people a day in this country is as if a jumbo jet airliner was crashing in this country every single day, yesterday, today, tomorrow, the day after that, every single day. If that were in fact the case, this country would grind to a halt immediately and address that issue. Where's the response? Where's the response to 300 Americans dying every single day from poisoning illicit drugs brought in, mostly from Mexican cartels? Where's the response?
Senator Kaufman.
Thank you. And I guess the other thing that we talked about, and again, it's not really a question, but well, maybe I can make it a question. So I said I would try and do what I could to help bring you in the community councils or other community meetings to do our best in that. So are there other things that you might ask of us to do to help popularize this issue other than this legislation?
Thank you, sir. From the chair to Senator Kaufman. Yes, I have mentioned that I'm the CEO of AK Fentanyl Response Project, and that is a community-based grassroots effort on my part to bring education, awareness, and prevention to communities all throughout Alaska through providing a literature table of a lot of DEA literature. I work closely with the DEA in Alaska and in Arlington, and providing naloxone training and distributing naloxone to as many people in this state as I can possibly get it to. I have a quick anecdote about that. I was in D.C. recently. I don't know who I've told this story to and who I haven't, but I was staying in a high-end hotel in Washington, D.C., and testifying for a lot of things related to fentanyl in D.C. And then I walked out my hotel room, and there was a dead man in the hallway of this hotel in D.C. He was blue. He had no pulse. He had no respiration. I have naloxone. Naloxone is not available in D.C. widely, but I have it because it is available widely in Alaska. And I ran back to my room, revived the man. He turned white. His eyes opened, and he got up. He was dead in that hallway. So we're not talking about helping people with substance abuse disorder or asking them not to take drugs. We're asking them to please carry naloxone to keep people alive right now in the state of Alaska.
Thank you very much. And I would note that probably in the other offices you visited, we were all given a naloxone that we can now have in our office. But I have a different question You referenced in your testimony that you were interested in targeting the manufacturers and the importers, but you weren't so interested in targeting what I would describe as street dealers. Why do you make that distinction?
I make that distinction because that person that provided my son a small amount of fentanyl that day is probably a person with substance abuse disorder. I do not believe prison is the appropriate place for low-level drug dealers unless they have a long criminal history and they're felons. If it's low-level drug dealers, they need help. My son needed help. He didn't need prison. And likely the young man that was probably a friend of his that he ran into that day that provided that drug. So I hope that's not the intention of this law, is to put people with substance abuse disorder that are just trying to stay well in prison. I hope that those people get help. I hope those people get treatment. If you're a drug trafficker from Mexico and you're here to make money from people in Alaska that are suffering from substance abuse disorders, I hope you go to prison for second-degree murder.
Thank you. I don't see other questions, but I appreciate your perspective on that. It's helpful. We'll next turn to public testimony. And I would, because I know we got a little late start today, I would ask the indulgence of the committee that we can hear everyone that's here for public testimony today, even if that runs us a little over, although we may not. We're going to open public testimony. I'll first ask, is there anyone in the room who would like to provide public testimony? If so, please come forward. And you want to identify yourself for the record. And we limit public testimony to 2 minutes per person, so if you want to state your name, any affiliation you may have, and you can proceed.
My name is Karen Malcolm Smith, and I'm the president and founder of the David Dillon Foundation. By the way, thank you for allowing me to come for public testimony. And I'm also a member of the Alaska Mental Health Board, but this testimony is personal and does not reflect the opinions or recommendations of the board that I serve on.
The Mental Health Board as opposed to the Mental Health Trust Authority.
Right.
Okay.
Yes, I'm on the board, the advisory, yeah.
No, I'm just making sure because
right.
People don't always hear the distinction.
excuse me. I'd like to start by telling you that my 25-year-old son Dylan passed away in 2017 from a drug poisoning overdose that began, it was a 7-year battle that began with an ATV accident and a long-term prescription of opioids. And this beautiful, popular, clever little boy disappeared. But even in his addiction, he was in and out of his addiction for the next 7 years. He turned into a very chill man's man. And became a stellar boxer and had a great passion for songwriting and music. He had no felonies and he despised the idea of selling drugs. But he was trapped in his addiction. The preceding testimony that I have about his death is based on my own personal year and a half testimony. And it involves eyewitnesses, text messages, and audio recordings. On May of 2017, Dylan returned home from an out-of-state treatment center and opened his home to a woman that he'd recently met who needed a place to stay for the night. 3 days later, she refused to leave, stating that she had squatter's rights. During those 3 days, my son was comatose from drugs that the woman had provided, and he had a cute little Turnigan home. He took great pride in his home and got along great with the neighbors. They all respected him, the way he took care of his home. And that weekend, the neighbors said that there was minimum a dozen cars coming and going at any given time and up to 25 cars, and they never saw Dylan. And the reason they didn't call the police is because it was so uncharacteristic of him. So basically what happened was this woman turned his home into a trap house, which is a place that drug dealers use to sell drugs. As brave as he was, Dylan was unable to stand up for himself that weekend in the company of the woman's friends who were armed with guns. Early Monday morning, after the drug traffic subsided, Dylan physically threw the woman out of his home and barricaded the doors, along with another young man who apparently afterwards left the scene. At close to noon that same morning, my son was found dead from a polysubstance overdose poisoning. And to this day, we've never known what actually happened. After my year and a half investigation, I found out that this woman was a known drug dealer connected to an infamous family heroin ring with past multiple convictions and jail time. Her MO was to prey on kind, trusting, vulnerable people, set up shop, and then move from house to house each weekend. I have more information about her, but that's as much as I'll do today. I've been told by one of her distributors that there were 3 deaths associated with her at that point. The night of Dylan's passing, I found 2 notes. One written by Dylan. It was a to-do list, including his hopes and dreams. And including his to-do list with hopes and dreams for a sober future. And the other one was an accounts receivable by the woman, a list of the drugs she was selling, who she was selling it to, and the monies that were owed. And upon my insistence, homicide sent a team of policemen out there that turned out to be patrolmen that ended up losing the evidence because they weren't trained. This woman knowingly engaged in conduct that resulted in the death of my son with extreme indifference to the value of human life. So I have since formed the David Dylan Foundation, and each year I have different events, but I have an annual event at the Park Strip, a memorial cross signing, and I invite families to come down who've lost their loved ones to drug, substance misuse, or poisoning. And this year it was daunting. The line never stopped. And some of those women are online today to testify, mostly fentanyl poisoning. And I want to say that, that we're entering, it's human nature that we often dismiss what's incomprehensible, and this is. But in 2022, the DEA interdicted 27 million fentanyl-laced fake pills, 13,000 pounds of powder. What that equates to is enough fentanyl to kill the entire population of the United States and more. 2 milligrams or 2 grains are lethal. Alaska leads the U.S. death toll per capita with 169 recorded deaths, mainly between the ages of 18 and 45 years old. And if it were not for naloxone, I believe that number could be 20-fold, 30-fold, but it is. And that's a personal projection. We have no idea, but every person that sells drugs is aware that fentanyl could be laced in the drugs. So I implore you to vote yes on HB 66 because we are losing a generation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I don't see questions. Is there anyone else in the room that would like to provide public testimony? Hearing and seeing no one, we have online Stacy Isert calling in from Anchorage. Ms. Isert, if you would want to state your name for the record. I was actually pretty liberal in giving a lot of extra time to the last testifier, but I'd ask you to keep your comments to 2 minutes. Ms. Isert, please identify yourself and proceed.
Yes, my name is Stacy Isert, and I'm here to support House Bill number 66. March 10th, 2021 was the worst day of my life and the beginning of the nightmare, which has become my everyday reality. That day 2 years ago, our son, Jason, died from chemical homicide from fentanyl poisoning at the age of 41. Jason had a master's degree in English literature and worked as a high school teacher. He loved music and was an awesome drummer and saxophone player. He married in 2016 and had 2 sons, and they were the apple of his eye. Jason always had a warm hug for anyone who may need it and would literally give the shirt off his back to help someone in need. When Jason's marriage fell apart, he he began to self-medicate. After losing everything in the divorce, he was devastated and made some unhealthy decisions. Then on March 10th, 2021, unbeknownst to him, he ingested some lethal drugs which contained a deadly dose of fentanyl. Jason's roommate stepped out for half an hour to pick up groceries, and when he returned, he found Jason dead in the bathroom. He called 911 and performed CPR, but it was too late. Jason was gone. What followed was the police coming to our door telling us the fateful news of Jason's passing. No parent should ever have to endure the immense pain that we experienced that night and continue to endure every day. We lost a son, and his children will never know their daddy. Jason's brother lost his sibling and his sons and uncle, not to mention the family members, friends, and colleagues who lost this wonderful man. Jason was adamant about being an organ donor, but due to the legal lethal way he died, they were unable to use his organs to save someone else's life. Our lives are forever changed and will never be the same. So yes, I support House Bill number 66. My son's death was an act of homicide by those persons who knowingly manufactured or delivered a controlled substance to Jason. There isn't a prison sentence for these individuals that can compare to the prison sentence that my husband and I endure every day. Some days are so painful that I don't feel I can go on. The grief, pain, and heartache will never cease and will be my prison sentence until the day I take my last breath. Unfortunately, our story is just one of thousands. How many more lives will be lost and families ruined due to this disregard for human life and blatant act of homicide? There must be consequences for their actions. Thank you for hearing me today.
Thank you, Ms. Eisert, and we want to send our condolences for your loss as well. I don't see any questions from the committee. Next online is Julie Beauchard. Ms. Beauchard, if you want to identify yourself for the record, please proceed with your comments.
Good afternoon. Yeah, my name is Julie Beauchard. I live in Palmer, Alaska. I'm calling in full support of these bills. You see, I lost my son, Tad Lee, on July 15th, 2021, due to someone delivering him a lethal dose of fentanyl. He was just 21 years old. He had his whole life in front of him. He did not want to die. He actually trusted this person, but he was deceived to death. Since his death, I have learned that this person's sister has also died from fentanyl poisoning. And who knows how many more deaths she is personally responsible for. There is currently an open trooper investigation going on at this time, so I can't give a whole lot of details. But we are looking at some evidence that was found to point to her. I personally know five other mothers in Alaska who have lost their children to fentanyl, and I'm sure there's many more that I don't know about. In 2021, there were 245 deaths from fentanyl poisoning in Alaska, which in turn means that 245 families suffered a devastating loss of their loved ones, a 68% increase that is completely unacceptable. Fentanyl poisoning is truly a nationwide and an Alaskan pandemic that needs to be stopped. We need to treat this seriously and charge these people with second-degree murder. Locking these people up and getting them off the streets is the only way to ensure that they don't keep killing our kids. This was an adult female who fully knew what she was doing, and the thought of her getting away with murdering my son is just too much for me and my family to bear. Please pass these laws to get some kind of justice for these people who are murdering many Alaskans and leaving families devastated in their wake. Thank you again for this opportunity to give my personal story, and I hope my son's murder will be a reminder to you when you're voting for these bills and pushing things forward. My closing comment is these are not overdoses. This is downright senseless murder. Thank you again for the opportunity to speak today.
Thank you very much, Ms. Bouchard. And again, on behalf of the committee, we want to express our condolences for your loss as well. I do not
Thank
have
you.
Anyone else in the queue to provide public testimony, and I don't see anyone in the room who has not, what looks appears, hasn't already testified. So we're going to close public testimony on Senate Bill 64. And we're going to hold Senate Bill 64 for further review. We're going to adjourn for the day. Our next meeting is Friday, March 24th at 1:30 p.m. If anyone is considering offering an amendment to Senate Bill 37, Crime Counterfeit Non-Functioning Airbag, sponsored by my office, please let our office know and submit those proposed amendments electronically by 5 p.m. on Sunday, March 26th. And we will stand adjourned now. The time is 3:09 p.m.